Om Vishnumare Krishna Vista Mutale Shimate Bhaktivinanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sasvani Deme Govani Pachane Nivishisha Sanyavani Pasitana Shatarine Anchaka Badu Vesha Kripa Sinavi Vata Patitanam Pavani Vyo Vaishnavi Vyo Namo Nama Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadada Srinivasini Govaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So first of all I'd like to thank you very much for allowing me to say a few words this morning, and I'm humbly asking for the blessings of all the present Vaishnavas and especially senior devotees, so I'll be successful in somehow serving you and pleasing you in some little way. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Canto 10, chapter number 57, verse number 16. Yes? Doesn't say the number, but I think it's 16, huh?
Yes.
So I'll chant the Sanskrit. Yasaptahayana Shailam Utpatyake Napanina Jajara Lilaya Bala Utsilindam Ivavaka Yasaptahayana Shailam Utpatyake napanina Jadara lilaya bala Utsilindam ivavaka.
Uprooting.
Ekana. with a single.
Panina.
Hand.
Dadara.
Held up.
Lilaya.
As play.
Bala.
A mere child.
Uchilindam.
A mushroom.
Eva.
As.
Albaka.
A boy. Translation. As a child of seven, Krishna uprooted an entire mountain and held it aloof as easy as a young boy picks up a mushroom. You repeat responsibly. As a child of seven, Krishna uprooted an entire mountain and held it aloof as easily as a young boy picks up a mushroom. So there's no purport, so we'll read the next verse, number 17. Namastasma Bhagavate Krishnaya Bhutakamane Anantaya Ributtaya Kutasayatmane Nama. Translation. I offer my obeisances to that Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, whose every deed is amazing. He is the Supreme Soul, the unlimited source and fixed center of all existence. Again, no purport, so we'll read the next verse as well. Pratyakhyata satinapi satadanva mahamanim tasminyasya sva aruya satayodanagam yayo. Translation. His appeal, thus rejected by a Akrura, also, Satadanva placed the precious jewel in Akrura's care and fled on a horse that could travel 100 yojanas, in brackets 800 miles. There's a little purport. The term nyasya, leaving in the care of, implies Satadanva now believed the jewel was his. Thus, he was leaving it in the care of a friend. In blunt terms, this is a thief's mentality. So even though it's a very short purport, I thought I'll still stop there because there's a few nice points in there, which gives me enough to talk about, I think. So the chapter is called Satrajit Murdered and the Jewel Returned. And as we discussed the last few mornings, so the story is that Satadanva had killed Satrajit in order to get the Samantaka jewel back. And now Krishna was after him to get him. And therefore Satadanva is fleeing in great fear. And in the first two verses we actually have Akrura speaking. Because what Satadanva is doing is he's trying to seek shelter in his flee, because he realizes Krishna is after him and sooner or later he's going to get him. So he is approaching first Kritavarma and asking him for protection, but Kritavarma refuses and says, well, you have offended the Supreme Lord, so I don't want to get involved in this, you know. We all know what happens when one offends the Supreme Lord and not follows his requests. So I'm sorry, I cannot help you. So, and then he is approaching Akrura, and he says a similar thing. He says, let me see. Who would oppose the two personalities of Godhead if he knew their strength? We were reading that verse yesterday. And then today, that's why he is glorifying Krishna as lifting Govardhan Hill like a little mushroom. In other words, he's trying to say, well, the Lord is doing so many amazing things. He has such unimaginable powers. So who would be such a fool to oppose him? And he continues to glorify the Lord. But he is refusing to give shelter. So and therefore, Satadhanva decides, all right, let me leave that jewel in Akrura's care. So, and as we hear in the purport, he's not doing that in that mentality. He's not handing over the jewel because he realizes, yes, actually, I should give it to Akrura, because after all, this is Krishna's desire. But no, he is actually thinking still, it is mine. And I'm simply leaving it in his care because Krishna is after me and he will get me. And, you know, this is usually the system when you stole something and the police is after you. You want to make sure you don't have that on you, what you have stolen, you know, because then you will be in real trouble. So he was thinking, well, if I leave it with the Akrura, then, you know, if Krishna gets me, I could say, what jewel? What are you talking about? I don't know. I don't have it. You can look. I don't have it. So therefore he thinks, all right, let me leave it with the Akrura and there it is safe and let me just keep running. So, and this is what he's doing. So therefore he actually maintains this mentality of a thief. So, and ultimately, we can say actually this is every living entity's position in this material world, that we all have this mentality of a thief. And we are all claiming proprietorship over something which is actually not really ours. So, you know, we can very easily imagine, let's say we borrow something from a friend, we borrow a mobile phone just to quickly use it, and we have it for one day, one week, one month, one year, 10 years, we just continue using it. And then our friend comes back and says, oh, you know, can I have my mobile phone back? And we say, what? This is mine. I have been using it for so many years. What are you talking about? This is my mobile phone. And we simply forget that we actually borrowed it one day. So that would mean we are really a thief. We have stolen. So this is basically the position of the living entity in the material world. So the Supreme Lord, he has given us something. He has lent us something, ultimately, to use in his service. But because for so many lifetimes we have been in this position of borrowing something, lifetime after lifetime, we start thinking, yes, this is actually my property. It belongs to me. So, and therefore, we are actually all a thief, really, to a greater or lesser degree. So, Prabhupada also explains in one nice purport, he explains what it actually means to live in actual reality. And there this dealing propensity is one aspect of illusion. So this is in the also 10th canto, 14th chapter, so we read that already some time ago. There Prabhupada says, one who accepts the kingdom of God as his home, the Lord himself as the object of all love, and the material universe as paraphernalia for being engaged in the Lord's service, he dwells within eternal reality, wherever he may go within the material or spiritual worlds. So basically, to live in actual reality means three things. It means that we clearly understand that the kingdom of God is our home, not Melbourne, Australia, our cozy flat, whatever it may be. No, it's actually the spiritual world is our real home. And the Lord himself as the object of all love, not our family members. Those relationships are also important, but they are not meant to fulfill that desire, that hankering in the heart for this sublime love we are all looking for. But no, that relationship with the Supreme Lord, that is meant for fulfilling that desire. And the third point, which is relating to our situation, and that the material universe is a paraphernalia for being engaged in the Lord's service, not in our service. for the Lord's pleasure, not for our pleasure. So that's the three nice points which Prabhupada gives, which describe actual reality. So the problem is that we are all living in this illusory dreaming world of thinking that this is our real home, and our family members, especially this man-woman relationship, this will fulfill our hankering for sublime love, and then everything around us is simply meant for our enjoyment. This is what we think. We all see ourselves as the center of everything, and whatever we see around us, we think, how can I use this for myself? Can I get a hand on this one and that one and use it and enjoy with it? So, and in this way we are all safe. Yes. So also there's many nice other purports which I'm always collecting when I'm reading, because I have such bad memory, I cannot memorize verses or things like that. So I'm always writing them in my little verse book. And there is one nice verse which describes how a householder should actually live in order to not be a thief. Yeah, so let me quickly find it. Here it is, 7th canto. Prabhupada describes, one who is content and satisfied and who links his activities with the Supreme Personality of Godhead residing in everyone's heart enjoys transcendental happiness without endeavoring for his livelihood. Where is such happiness for a materialistic man who is impelled by lust and greed and who therefore wanders in all directions with his desire to accumulate wealth? So in other words, this is a problem that usually people that try and follow their lusty and greedy desires to accumulate more and more wealth, but ultimately instead of finding that happiness which they are looking for, they actually only get entangled in misery. And there's somewhere another one which I was actually looking for. Hang on here. Yes, here, in the same chapter. One may claim proprietorship to as much wealth as required to maintain body and soul together. But one who desires proprietorship over more than that must be considered a thief. That was the one I was looking for. And he deserves to be punished by the laws of nature. So there we have again the thieving mentality and position. So in other words, we are actually only allowed to keep for ourselves really as much as necessary to keep body and soul together. And anything else has to be used in the Lord's service. And if we don't do that, if we use more for ourselves than what is necessary to keep body and soul together, then we get entangled. We are thief, and we will get some reaction. We will be punished for that. So now if we look at it, how much is actually necessary in order to keep body and soul together? Well, not very much. Not very much at all. So there we can see how much we are all actually thieves. We all, I mean, especially in the Western world, you know, we all keep so much more than necessary in order to keep body and soul together. And actually, I remember I had this really strong realization in this regard. That was when the first time when I came to Latvia. So Latvia is part of the former Soviet Union. And, you know, in 1989, we went there for preaching. So 1989 was still the communist days. So in the communist days, the communist principle is no luxuries. You can only get the bare necessity. And that is quite easily available, but you cannot get anything else much than that, not with a lot of endeavor and connections and so on. So I remember 1989, first time I went to Riga, to Latvia. Riga is the capital city, and it's got about 1 million people there. And I was completely amazed how few shops were in the whole city. A city of 1 million people. How many millions has Melbourne got? Huh? 4 million. All right, so it's a little smaller than Melbourne. But in any case, 1 million people is quite a considerable city. And there was only so few shops. You really had to look for them. You just couldn't find any shops. And there was not even any... Once you found a shop, you wouldn't even know what the shop was selling. There was no advertisement or nothing. You had to really go inside and see what can you get here, you know. And I remember there was this big photo shop. And so we thought, all right, let's check it out. And we went in there. But there was just nothing there to buy. And there was this huge, big showcase, this huge, big wooden table with a nice glass cupboard. And there was this one really old camera in there, in this whole big showcase, you know, one old camera. And I was thinking, wow, this is amazing. A whole city, a whole country runs like this. Then you just can't buy anything much, you know. And of course there were some shops with vegetables, but just the basic things, just potatoes, carrots and cabbage, and that was it. You know? And you know, and for many things you had to queue up for quite a few hours, you know, to get it. And if you were unlucky, it was just your turn when the stuff was finished, you know, after queuing up for 3 hours or something, you know. So, and I really had this realization, wow, this is amazing. You know, a whole country, a whole city can nicely function like that. And the funny thing was, people actually looked quite happy. You know, there was nice parks there. People had plenty of time because they didn't have to work so hard to buy all these unnecessary things. So, you know, there was parks there and children were playing and the grown-ups, they were playing chess with these huge big chess game, you know, moving them around there. And yeah, board games, this and that, you know, in the middle of the week, people had time and they looked actually happy, you know, they looked quite happy. But you just couldn't buy anything much at all, you know, and that really gave me the realization, actually, Western life really means it's a whole race. Who can produce most unnecessary things? And that country is considered advanced, who can come up with more and more crazy and ridiculous ideas what to produce and what to bring on the market, which is absolutely, completely unnecessary and unwanted. And everybody really participates in this race, you know, and thinks, yes, this is normal, and actually this is advanced. The more unnecessary things I can surround myself with, the more advanced I am, and the more I'm actually getting ahead in life. This is what people think. But in actuality, it's real madness, actually. It's complete insanity. But everybody just spends their whole life like this, you know. And then sooner or later, we collapse in exhaustion and give up our body, and whole life is wasted. And we can't take anything with us anyway. And the point is, we are thieves. We are thieves, and we will get some punishment for it. We will get entangled, and we will suffer for it. Definitely, you know, even if we might think we get away with it or whatever, but it will catch up to us, because it will force us to take birth again. And usually, also the point is, the more wealth we usually have, the more we engage in illicit and sinful activities. And for that, again, more and more punishment is coming. So in that way, really, this is actually the secret of success, especially in the Grihastha Ashram, in spiritual life, that one has to stick to this formula, not taking more for oneself, which is absolutely necessary in order to keep body and soul together. if we really can make that principle our principle in life, then we will be successful. Then we will not get entangled like that. Another nice situation where we can realize that is when we go, for example, on Navadvip Mandala Parikrama in Mayapur. How little we need to keep body and soul together, and how happy we are. You know, anybody's done the Navadvip Mandala Parikrama in Mayapur? No? Oh, not many people, huh? Just two or three people. Yeah, very nice realization, because there all you have with you is just a, you know, three sets of cloth and a bucket to take baths and a sleeping mat and your japa beads, and that's basically it. That's all you need. And you just walk from place to place and you chant and you hear about Krishna and you're perfectly happy with the utmost bare necessities of life. And you really feel so happy, so blissful. And you think, wow, you know, all these things I have at home, I actually don't really need them. No need for them. It's all excess baggage, actually. You know, like when you know, I travel a lot usually, so, you know, it's always my crucial point, you know, not having more than 20 kilos with me to check in, you know, and anything else is excess luggage, and you have to pay, you know, very expensive, you know, $10 per kilo or something. So that's the thing. We are all carrying a lot of excess luggage with us around, which is just entangling and giving headaches. And these experiences on Parikrama, they give you that realization. And when you come home, you think, wow, let's get rid of a few things here, you know, and let me just really try and be voluntarily poor. Because that's actually how a devotee has to live. He has to be voluntarily poor. That's why Prabhupada is saying, simply living. So the point is, even a person who gets more wealth by Krishna's arrangement anyway, he should only accept anyway what's necessary to keep body and soul together in order not to be a thief. So it means you have to be poor. Even if you have more wealth, you're not allowed to really enjoy it. So you have to agree to voluntarily be poor. So that means, in other words, then there's not even any need to endeavor so much to get more wealthy, because you will not enjoy it anyway. You should not. You cannot, unless you want to be a thief. So then what's the use of working so hard and making all these plans to get more and more? So if we accept that principle, then we can be very relaxed in this way, and we can say, well, let me just see whatever Krishna gives me, and he gives me more. I have to be voluntarily poor anyway, and I'll use everything for the preaching. And it gives me very little. Well, as long as it is enough to keep body and soul together, that's my quota anyway. I'm not entitled to take more. So, all right, let me be satisfied with that. So in that way, you know, we guard ourselves against that impediment of over accumulating and over endeavoring, which Rupa Goswami is describing as one of the main dangers in spiritual life in Nectar of Instruction. So in that way, you know, we have to agree to live voluntarily poor. And there's also a nice purport where Prabhupada is describing that. In the sixth canto, Prabhupada is saying, in other words, a pure Brahmana, especially Brahmins, voluntarily accepts a life of poverty and lives in complete dependence on the mercy of the Lord. The conclusion is that although a Brahmana may receive much opulence from his disciples, well, doesn't have to be disciples, can be in whatever way, he should not utilize the rewards of his priesthood for his personal benefit. He must use them for the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yeah, so voluntarily poor. And I notice this is not easy for devotees in the Western world. You know? not easy, because simply because you're surrounded by this whole propaganda, by this whole madness, having to accumulate so many things. So I usually spend my main time in countries where people are forced to live poor. So usually I preach in Ukraine and Bangladesh and Nepal. They're my favorite places. Actually, Ukraine and Bangladesh, they're my favorite places. And they are places where people are very poor and they have to live very simple. And you definitely can see in such environment where people live very simple, people are more attracted to spiritual life. It is actually much easier for them to realize that there is simply no other source of happiness in this world except Krishna consciousness. Like Ukraine is a country where winter goes from, let me think, from September till April is winter. And not like this winter, you know, but it's really heavy winter, minus 20, minus 25, ice and snow, you know, no green leaf on the tree, everything is grey and, you know, people look really miserable, you know, and all wrapped up in so many coats and jackets and boots and, oh my God, it takes half an hour just to get dressed so you can go outside, you know, because you have to put on so many things, you know, to survive, you know. So very, very austere, you know. But there are people so eager for spiritual life, like ISKCON, so prominent. Hundreds of devotees, and they just, you know, for them it's much easier to understand, yes, there is really no source of happiness in this world, let me just dive into Krishna consciousness, you know. So you can say actually, like, the standard of life and spiritual advancement is like a scale, you know, on the veggie market. So when standard of life and sense gratification goes up, self-realization goes down. And if you want self-realization to go up, then sense gratification has to go down. You know, there's no scales where both sides go up. Sense gratification and self-realization doesn't exist. So it's really, and you can see that very nicely when you travel in different countries where there is different standards of life. You can see very clearly, you know, as soon, the more west you go, you know, like, let's say we look from India, you know, and the more west we go, the more the standard of comfort and standard of sense gratification goes up. And we can say the more the interest in self-realization goes down, you know. So, in that way, you know, it is actually to some degree, we can say it is even a blessing to be a little poor. And in that regard, I also found some very interesting purports where Prabhupada is describing the benefits of being poor. So, of course, we know there's one purport where Prabhupada says, actually, if a person is poverty-stricken, which means he doesn't have enough to keep body and soul together, then that is also not good, because that brings bad qualities out. You know, then he easily becomes a thief or whatever, or dishonest and so on. So poverty-stricken one should not be. That is a problem for spiritual life as well. And that means not having enough to keep body and soul together. But to be poor in the sense that we have just enough to keep body and soul together, that is a blessing. And I want to read you a few of my purports which I collected here. So also a 10th canto. I'm not sure whether Prabhupada says it or Prabhupada's disciples. But in any case, it is said, always hungry, longing for sufficient food, a poverty-stricken man gradually becomes weaker and weaker. Having no extra potency, his senses are automatically pacified. A poverty-stricken man, therefore, is unable to perform harmful, envious activities. There you go. He has no money to perform harmful, envious activities. In other words, such a man automatically gains the results of the austerities and penances adopted voluntarily by saintly persons. So, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? So, a poor man, automatically he gains the results of the austerities and penances adopted voluntarily by a saintly person, just because he is forced to live so simple, and he simply cannot endeavor in any harmful and envious activities because he hasn't got the resources to endeavor for it. So then in the next purport, Prabhupada makes another nice point. He says, saintly persons may freely associate with those who are poverty-stricken, but not with those who are rich. A poverty-stricken man, by association with saintly persons, very soon becomes uninterested in material desires. And the dirty things within the core of his heart are cleansed away. Also, very nice point. So, poverty-stricken man, but let's understand it in such a way that he still has enough to keep body and soul together. Which, we really don't need much for that. You know? So just by the association of a saintly person, he becomes very quickly uninterested in sense gratification. Because he hasn't got the means anyway, he cannot even plan. His head is not full of all kinds of schemes and plans how to enjoy. So if such a person gets the saintly association, he very easily, he can be given a higher taste, so to speak. Because he doesn't have to kick out all those, you know, plans for material desires from his head, you know. So, and then there's another one. Actually, that was the verse, and now comes the purport. And there they say, sadhus, saintly persons, want to preach to both the poor and the rich. But the poor take more advantage of the sadhu's preaching than the rich do. A poor man receives sadhus very quickly, offers them obeisances, and tries to take advantage of their presence, whereas a rich man keeps a big greyhound dog at his door so that no one can enter his house. Pretty funny, isn't it? Greyhound dogs, very popular in Australia. The dog races. So, he puts a sign saying, beware of dog, and avoids the association of a saintly person. Whereas a poor man keeps his door open for them, and thus benefits by their association more than a rich man does. Very nice. And you can see that very clearly too, you know. I remember, like, Latvia is also, even now, even though now the communist days are over and it's full on capitalism there, and then the city nearly looks like the West now, one shop after the other, you know, after so many years, 18 years, you know, things have completely changed. But if you go in the country, people are still quite poor, especially the old people. So, and sometimes I have a Sankirtan van in Europe parked there waiting for me every now and again when I come. So, and sometimes I take the Madhujis on book distribution in Latvia. I put them all in my van and we go out and we sleep in the van. It's all decked out and I can cook inside and everything. And usually, because I don't speak the local language, I don't speak Russian or Latvian, I mainly do the backing up for them. I cook for them and go shopping and I get them out. But in the afternoons, I usually go with them and I try and inspire them what to say and so on. So in there, so many times I made this experience, you know, that you go to a really poor person's home, you know, but they invite you in, they're so happy to see you, they're friendly, they take a book, they open their wallet, they take the last few cents out. Here, all right, I'll give you all my last money. And they smile, they're happy. Because, you know, they have that piety somehow in their heart. And their heart is not so hard-hearted. You know? So they are, you know, just all right, here, whatever you, I can give you, I will give you, you know. And then you see a more fancy house, you know. And so often I fall into this trap, I think, oh, let me go there, you know, maybe I'll be able to sell more than one book, you know. But then exactly what is described in this purport happens, you know, that you don't even get in the door, you know. There's a big fence, barking dog, really ferocious dog, and you don't even want to open the gate, you know, and then you ring the bell, and then after a while somebody, some little window opens, so what do you want, you know. And then they see, oh, she's got some books, you know. Nah, forget it, not interested, you know, not interested. And once I remember, I even, you know, I managed to hit up a person, you know, but then he was just really saying, I have worked so hard for this house, for my money, it's all mine, I will not give anything to anybody, like this, you know, just completely in this illusion, yes, this is all mine, I have worked for it and it's mine, you know, very hard-hearted, although it wouldn't hurt him just to give $1 or something, but no, you know, so this is exactly that principle, you know, I've experienced it so many times. That's exactly the principle, you know, that actually a poor person can take more advantage of a saintly person's association. So that, again, that's why that recommendation is there. Prabhupada is giving it to us, simply living, high thinking. So, and really, this is one of my, you know, realizations that for Western devotees, it's often very difficult to come to terms with that, and they just somehow they, you know, want to have the same standard of life like the non-devotees around them, you know. But then we actually will not be able so easily to take advantage of the presence of a saintly person, unless we really have this attitude of really voluntarily be poor and really only use the bare minimum for ourselves, and whatever extra we have, we make our home into a temple. We are very generous, inviting devotees, feeding them, having programs in our home. This is one of the main duties of the Grihastha Ashram, to give in charity. And one way of giving in charity is to feed living entities. There's also many nice verses where it says, you know, that this is a devotee's, a Grihastha's main duty. Here, 7th canto, there's one nice one where it says, one should feed animals such as deers, camels, asses, monkeys, mice, snakes, birds, and flies, exactly like one's own sons. How little difference there actually is between children and these innocent animals. Yes, so this is actually the duty of the Grihastha Ashram, to distribute prasad to all living entities. What to speak of devotees and saintly persons. And that's also one thing we really neglect in the Western world, you know. That's one thing you learn when you go to Bangladesh. Oh, people really have this hospitality, you know. Sometimes when we travel there, we have these prasadam programs, you know, where we just go, where the grihasthas all come, please come to our home, take prasad, please come. And sometimes, oh, we just had a meal and we really can't eat, you know, but they're so insistent, you have to come to their home, you have to sit down, you have to take something. So and then we just go from one grihasthas home to the other, you know, and everywhere we have to eat. And then there, in every Hindu's home you find a harmonium, you find a madanga, you find cartels. So you don't only eat, but yes, they get the harmonium out, here please, play some bhajan kirtan. And they all know the songs, you know, all these Vaishnav songs, Bhajau Remana, Shri Krishna Chaitanya. This is all folk songs there. Everybody knows the words, they all know it's Bengali anyway, you know. So and then they get the Bhagavad Gita out, here, please speak something. Like this, you know, so you have to have kirtan, you have to speak something, then comes the prasad, And then Nittai Guru Haribol, you go to the next place, same thing, you know, like this. And sometimes you're so full, you just can't eat anymore, but people get so offended if you don't accept prasad, because they know that's their duty, and they know they will get some benefit from that, from serving the devotees. So sometimes it nearly seems like they're a little too concerned about their benefit, you know, rather than actually serving you, you know. It just really pushed you, you have to eat, you know. So, yes, but that is actually one of the main duties in the Grihastha Ashram. And there's a nice purport also, in, I think it's Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Prabhupada says, as far as he can think back, when he was a child, he's saying there was never a single day where his parents received less than minimum 4 guests a day. Isn't that amazing? Not a single day Prabhupada can remember where there was less than 4 guests coming and taking prasad in his parents' home. Not a single day. So that means minimum 4. So that means some days it might have been 8 or 10, you know, but never ever less than 4. You see? So yes, so if a Grihastha is blessed by a little bit more opulence, he actually should use all his means in that way, by serving the Vaishnavas, serving the Sankirtan mission, making his home a temple, being very generous, you know, having his doors always open, and feeding all living entities, not only Guru, but also the devotees, and not only the devotees, but even the innocent animals, such as deer, camels, asses, monkeys, mice, snakes, birds, and flies. Because it says, how little difference is there actually between children and these innocent animals? So that's the proper use of anything extra we have, which is not necessary in order to keep body and soul together. In this culture, you know, you really find this in places like Bangladesh. Very wonderful to see, you know. There you really get an experience, you know, what Vaishnava life is all about. Because this is really one problem we have in the West, that we might understand the philosophy very nicely, but we don't have the culture. In fact, we are quite uncultured, really, you know. But in places like Bangladesh, there you see the whole Bhajan Kirtan culture, or the, you know, a lot of devotees that play really wonderfully the instruments, and they know all the songs and the traditional melodies, and oh, you know, there's devotees who play mandanga. Like my translator I'm traveling with there usually, he knows 35 beats. How many do you know? I mean, 35 beats, that's quite a lot, you know. Very, very expert, you know. And then, yeah, Bhajan Kirtan culture, Prasadam culture, you know. And people, I mean, sometimes we do programs in villages, you know. There's no electricity there. I mean, you really have the feeling, this is what it must have been like when Krishna was on the planet. Just completely simple village life, you know, just amazingly beautiful. So we do programs there, and people come from all the surrounding villages. They all come, they all hear about it. You don't even have to do much advertisement. They all hear about it. Yes, there the sadhus are coming, there will be program. And they all come, and some of them, they walk for a whole day. They walk the whole day, and then they come in the evenings. And usually the program starts around 7 o'clock. We start with Tulsi Adi, Gaurati, and then the whole night we have Bhajan Kirtan, some Kata, some Bhajan Kirtan, some Kata. Sometimes programs go to 12 o'clock, and then there's a drama. We have a drama group. Then midnight comes the drama. And then 2 o'clock in the morning comes the Krishna cinema. So it goes the whole night through, you know. Of course, the devotees, they don't always take part in the whole thing, because you want to kind of have a little bit of sadhana too and get up early in the morning and all that. So often we don't stay up the whole night, but for them it goes the whole night. So this is their natural recreation. They don't have computers. they don't waste their time, you know, sitting on the computers checking out this website and that website. And a lot of them don't have TV because there's no electricity anyway. They just light the oil lamps in the evenings like that. So this is their recreation, to hear about the Lord and to chant the holy name, to get together in Bhajan Kirtan. That's why they have the instruments in every home. You find them there. So, you know, and then that gives you a realization, yes, if I just kick out from my life all these unwanted things from my brain, which I'm, you know, getting as a thief anyway, if I kick them all out and eliminate them all from my life, then I can actually, you know, get to this mood of just accepting this culture wholeheartedly in my life and really make Krishna consciousness not only just some philosophy or which I hear on a Sunday or whenever Guru comes or whatever, but where it actually is really integrated in our daily life. And whatever free time we have, we get together, we have Bhajan Kirtan, we read, we hear, and we attend programs like that. So it's a very wonderful experience. So in any case, just to come to a finish, yes, unless we give up this thieving mentality and hand back the Shamantaka jewel to Krishna, however big or small it might be, it will be hard to really actually really make progress and really get a taste, a higher taste for that, you know, spiritual happiness and pleasure which is available there for all of us. So maybe I'll finish there and see if there's any comments, any questions. I was actually planning to finish, you know, with a little story, which in one sense has some parallels with the story we're discussing now, but then again it has different aspects too. You probably all know the story. It's the story with Sanatan Goswami and his touchstone. Well, you know, I'm always remembering that story over the last few days when we were discussing, you know, because there we also have one Brahmana worshipping Lord Shiva, you know, and he approaches Lord Shiva for the highest benediction, and Lord Shiva says, you go to Sanatana Goswami, he will be able to give you the highest benediction. So, and then that Brahmana, he knows Sanatana Goswami, he has a touchstone. And that touchstone is very similar to the Shamantaka jewel, because whatever you touch it to immediately transforms into solid gold. And he's thinking, yes, Sanatana Goswami, I will ask him for that touchstone. That's what I want. And he's already thinking, I can transform everything around me into solid gold. All I have to do is just touch it and it becomes solid gold. Wow, fantastic. So he goes to Sanatana Goswami and he says, Lord Shiva sent me to you and I want to have the highest benediction from you, and I know you've got this touchstone, so can I have it? And Sanatana Goswami says, yes, sure, you can have it, no problem. And the Brahmana thinks, well, where is it? Maybe he's keeping it on the altar and worshipping it, like Satyajit was doing. But Sanatana Goswami is not doing that. He's keeping it in the rubbish behind his house. And he's saying, yes, with great pleasure, you can go and get it. It's behind my house in the rubbish dump. You have to dive in there and get it out. So, and the Brahmana thinks, well, that was an easy one. All right, let's go and dig into the rubbish and find it. And he's in there with, you know, up to the elbows in all smelly rubbish just to find the touchstone. And then finally he finds it. But then, because he is a sincere devotee, he's coming to his senses and he's thinking, well, if Sanatana Goswami is not keeping this on the altar, he's not worshipping it like Satyajit, and he's keeping it in the rubbish, it really means He has to have something better. Otherwise he wouldn't keep it there. So, and then he's going back to Sananda Goswami and asking him. He's thinking, well, let me ask him. Maybe he's got something that's even much better than that. So, and he's asking him, do you have anything better? And Sananda Goswami is saying, yes, sure I have. And the Brahmin is saying, all right, I want that. You give me that. I came for the topmost thing, so I want that. So and then Sananda Goswami is saying, well, no problem, I can give you, but you have to throw first away the touchstone. You have to throw it in the pukur, in the pond behind the house, next to the rubbish bin, rubbish dump is the pukur. So you have to throw it in there, and then, only then, I'll give you the topmost thing. So, and again, because that brahmana, he is very sincere. He is not like Satyajit, hanging on to it, you know. He's saying, all right, I have that faith that there is something better. So he throws it away. So then Sananda Goswami is initiating him into chanting the holy name. So now, you know, we could imagine if we are in that situation, you know, we have a touchstone and we have the choice, you know. Do we want initiation? Then we have to throw away the touchstone. So, and we can be lucky, you know, that in one sense we are lucky that, you know, we get initiation before we have thrown away the touchstone, you know. We only have to follow a few principles for some time and come every now and again to the temple and we actually get that highest benediction of receiving initiation, you know. Even though we are hanging on to the touchstone, you know, we haven't thrown it away. You know. But the point is, if we really want to make advancement, sooner or later we have to come to the point where we let go, where we throw away the touchstone. And we have to really once and forever throw it away. You know, because we could imagine maybe the brahmana would have thrown it in the pond, but somewhere close to the edge where the water is shallow and where you can always get it back. Just in case, you know, whatever Sanatana Goswami would give him is not really better after all than the touchstone, you know. So that's probably what we might be doing, you know, that we pretend. We say, all right, no problem, we'll throw it away. But, you know, we remember where it is and we think, okay, let's just try this out. And if it's not so good, then I can always dive into the pond and get it back, you know. But the brahmana, he was not doing that. He was once and for all throwing it away. Because he had that faith that there's something available which is much better. So that's the point, you know. If we really want to get a higher taste and taste that nectar which is available for every one of us and which is meant for us, you know, the human form of life is really meant to strive for that nectar. And reinstall us in our eternal position, you know, of tasting ever increasing nectar all the time. There's no limit to it, ever increasing. So, but we can only get that if we really let go of the touchstone. Alright. Any comments? Come on, there must be something, you know. Usually if there's no comments, no questions, that means it was a boring class and you were all sleeping. Okay. Yeah, you hear this all the time actually, you know, every chapter in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we just finish it like that.
For a sutra, the brahmana gets mystic perfection, but the sutra gets devotional service. Even though a brahmana
that I would have to really see. I don't know. What is it really described like that? That the Brahmana gets mystic perfections, but the Sudra gets devotional service?
It says something along the lines of one who hears the pastimes of Krishna Maharaj, or might have been one of the pastimes of the festival. The Brahmana gets mystic perfections, the Kshatriya gets something along the lines of a prosperous kingdom, the Vaishya gets a control over all these adversaries.
Well, we could say lucky in Kali Yuga everybody is a sutra. So we will all get, you know, we will all get the benediction of devotional service. We will not be sidetracked by mystical perfections or whatever, you know. But, you know, maybe you could also understand it in such a way that, you know, that this is maybe some, I mean, I'm just speculating, what can I say? I would have to really look at it, you know. But, you know, maybe we could say it's just some preliminary thing for the Brahmanas, Vaishyas, and Kshatriyas, you know. And that ultimately they will also come to the platform of devotional service, because this is really what the whole Bhagavatam is all about, you know, to lift everybody beyond, you know, the Varnashram system. Because that's the thing, I mean, the whole Varnashram system is a material system. It is a material system in order to uplift everybody. It is not beyond the three modes of material nature. It is determined by the three modes of material nature. So Krishna gave us a material system for upliftment. But the ultimate goal is, by hearing and chanting, we get beyond the Varnashram system. You see, that's like the criteria of a person, whether he is, you know, in the Varnashram system or whether he is on the platform of a Vaishnava. That Vaishnava, through his taste of hearing and chanting and through the purification he received through regular hearing and chanting, He is beyond the Varnashram system. He doesn't care whether he's Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra. He can function in any capacity, whatever is necessary, and it's not a problem for him. What am I? Am I a Brahmana? Am I a Kshatriya? No deal. No big deal. He is situated in his eternal position as servant and nothing else. You know? So that is ultimately the goal of the Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita and so on, to get us to that platform, you know. And it simply comes through regular hearing and chanting, nothing else. That, you know, in the person who has a firm taste in that, he is reinstated in that position as servant. And he might be acting, you know, in certain capacities and doing his duties and so on. But because he has that firm taste for hearing and chanting, he is beyond the Varnas and Ashrams, you say. So it would be strange, you know, if the hearing of the pastimes, you know, simply keep us, you know, that's not the goal, you know.
I was just thinking in terms of it's so much easier for the sutra.
Oh, that's how you meant.
That's what I was kind of thinking. The sutra, because it was acceptable, as you were saying.
Well, it doesn't have to be a sutra. It can also be a poor brahmana. Kulavitsa Sridhar, you know. He was very poor. But he used everything, you know. Or he used half his income to worship Mother Ganges. And it certainly wasn't much he was earning with his banana leaves and plates, you know. So it doesn't have to be sutra. Doesn't have to be sutra.
Mataji, you said that the poor get too much attracted, but they get attracted for the material benedictions by their worship. They will get some material benediction. Is it okay?
I guess that's the unfortunate situation that, you know, the so-called Hinduism, how it is practiced these days in those countries, it is mainly it has become very materialistic, you know, and people are absorbed in demigod worship just to get some material benedictions and so on. So that, of course, is not that beneficial on the path of spiritual progress towards Krishna, you know. Definitely not. In fact, there's also a few nice purports where Prabhupada is saying, actually even Ravana and Kamsa, Hiranyakashipu, they were all demigod worshippers, you know. Hiranyakashipu, he was very, very respectfully worshipping Lord Brahma, very determinedly, you know, so, and he was a great demon, you know, so there you go.
But they were all liberated because they were thinking about Krishna all the time?
Yeah, that was their, you know, their good fortune, and that was the pastime and so on. But just these examples show us, you know, that just worshipping demigods doesn't mean you're a Vaishnava. Actually, there's also, I have somewhere a purport in that regard. I probably won't find it now. I've got too much nectar in there. But anyway, where Prabhupada is saying very clearly, you know, that actually asura means anybody who doesn't worship Krishna, he is an asura. Even if he worships demigods. And Prabhupada gives that example, yes. There's like Hiranyakashipu or Kamsa, Ravana. They were great demigod worshippers, you know. So anybody who is not worshipping Krishna is considered to be asura. So that means, you know, the main population of Hindus, in one sense, were just worshipping demigods, you know. You know, they're not suras, you know. Yeah.
How is it possible? Means it's like very much difficult for the. So what is the process for that? Means that wealthy man can understand that, you think?
Well, yeah, that's the problem, you know, because very often wealth, there's also purports where Prabhupada describes wealth very intoxicating. And for a wealthy person, often very difficult to hear this, you know. And I guess that's why, you know, we have more people joining ISKCON who are not so wealthy, you know. Although we have a lot of, you know, more wealthy people also who become devotees, like Ambarish Prabhu from America, you know, or whatever. But that's the point, yes. Wealth is very intoxicating, and for people like that, often very difficult to just wake up from that dreaming illusory, you know, illusory dream, I mean. And understand that actually their wealth is not theirs, and they're only entitled to keep what is necessary to keep body and soul together, and that they're really big thieves, actually. You know, very, very difficult to, you know, get them to that point. But I mean, all we can do is just try our best, feed them with prasadam, give them Prabhupada's books, try and make friends with them, cultivate them. And that's the point. I mean, if a living entity has a little bit of sincerity in their heart, you know, it will affect them. Doesn't matter, you know, even if they are very wealthy. All a living entity needs, the only qualification a person needs is that sincerity of some or other, you know, wanting to reestablish that relationship with the Lord, you know. So if there's some little sincerity there, then even a very wealthy person will respond to Prabhupada's mercy and Lord Chaitanya's mercy, you know. So I guess that's why we go out on Harinam like we went last night, you know, and so on, just to, you know, just to give some purification. Let them hear the holy name, let them see the devotees, let them take prasad at Gopal's crossways, you know. So it's a whole combined effort there, you know. There's so many different aspects that gradually leads to purification. And even if they don't come to Krishna consciousness in this life, but still, whatever little contact they had will be of eternal benefit, whatever prasad they had, whatever harinam they had will be of eternal benefit, and sooner or later they will get there. Maybe not in this life, but maybe in next life, you know. Alright, so we'll finish there. Also, as we know today, His Holiness Dipitaka Swami is coming and staying for the weekend and giving out some mercy. So we should be eager to serve and to hear, inquire. That's how we serve Guru and Sadhus. That we are eager to render some little service, whatever it may be. And that we are very eager to hear in an inquisitive mood. Okay, thank you very much. Ganta Achman Bhagavatam Ki, Shri Prabhupada Ki, Samarita Bhaktivinoda Ki, Yoga Kimananda Ki.